Good morning. In 1 second, everything had changed. That moment became a landmark for history. There will forever only be two chapters, before and after. I'm talking, of course, about the first time I arrived in Northern California. I was in high school. I had just moved from Connecticut to Texas. And I was visiting a friend out here in Northern California, and I know some of you out there like Texas, but you're here now, let me point out. So visiting Northern California was just a moment of glory, and I knew this is where I wanted to call home. Before that was pre-Northern California and after. Or I could be talking about that day in December 1999 when I said I do to a young woman. And nothing was ever the same after that moment, before and after. Or I could be talking about the day I held my first child in my arms, and that word, daddy, all of a sudden applied to me, before and after. There are moments that define our lives, powerful moments where everything changes, the way you look at yourself, the way you look at the world, the past takes new shape, and the future holds new possibilities. In case you're curious, if you do a web search for before and after, there are three categories of things that come up most often. You might be able to guess the first one. What do you think? Weight loss stories. Before and after weight loss. I'm not sure if I heard it. Second category is plastic surgery, so you'll find stories of plastic surgery. The third one's a little more surprising. It's stories about homeless dogs that have been rescued. Don't ask me why, but there are dozens of stories of homeless dogs if you search before and after. Happy Easter Sunday. Today is the day that the whole Christian story turns around. This is the hinge on which the story of our faith turns. Today defines the before and after of God's work in the world. The story we're going to be thinking about this morning, though, is not about the man who rose from the dead today. It's about two individuals who met that man, and in meeting him, their stories became changed forever. These two people had been there when Jesus was executed. They were in Jerusalem the morning that the empty tomb was discovered. And that night, they had a conversation going home with a guy they didn't quite recognize. But it was in that moment that everything changed for them. That moment set their hearts on fire. All the dots connected. Everything made sense. The story we're looking at is found in Luke chapter 24. It's on page 885 in the Bibles in your pews, if you'd like to follow along. And mostly this morning, we're just going to be walking through this story. My hope is that we would find ourselves wrapped up in the drama of what happens to these two people. That we would find ourselves in their places, perhaps. But as we go through the story, there's three questions that are asked. Two are asked of these two travelers, and one is asked by them at the end. I'm going to stop at points in the story and invite these questions to be our questions. Ask us to let these questions probe our hearts and perhaps discover something about ourselves and about the man whose resurrection we celebrate today. So let's meet these two travelers and let's see the moment that divided their lives into before and after. The story begins with a road trip. Luke 24, verses 13 to 14. That very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and they were talking with each other about all these things that had happened. Now, that very day refers to the day that the empty tomb was discovered. The two of them refers to two disciples. We don't know who they are at first. Later in the story, we hear that one of them is named Cleopas. And in John's gospel, there's a different individual or a different name of Clopas, who some people think might be the same individual. In John's gospel, Clopas' wife, Mary, was at the cross when Jesus died. So it's a bit of speculation, but some people think that this pair here were actually Mary and Clopas, a married couple leaving Jerusalem. They were going to a village named Emmaus. The fact that we don't know really anything at all about this village tells us a lot about it. It means it was kind of a nothing place, an insignificant little village without much importance beyond itself. There'd be no real reason to go to it unless you lived there. So this is probably a story of a married couple going home after a long and tiring week. They were talking about stuff as they went. In the next verse, we hear they were discussing together. And this word discussing is often translated debating or arguing. When I got married, I thought that healthy couples didn't have fights. So my wife and I had serious conversations occasionally. And I'm pretty sure that Mary and Clopas were tired, they were confused, they just wanted to get home and go to bed, and they were having a serious conversation on their way home about all the things that had happened. They probably weren't walking alone. They had just returned from Jerusalem during the week of Passover, where the population of that city swelled from 30,000 to about 150,000. So on this road leaving the city, there were probably other travelers. And at some point, one of those other travelers kind of caught up with them and started to chat with them. They don't recognize him, but he seems vaguely familiar. Here's Luke 24, starting in verse 15. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is this conversation that you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" The familiar stranger asks them, "What are you talking about?" And they're stunned. He really doesn't seem to know. This is like showing up in Ferguson, Missouri, with people holding picket signs and saying, "Hey, what's going on?" People say, "Don't you know? There is only one thing going on right now. There is only one topic of conversation. There is nothing else that you could be talking about except what has just happened." But how would you explain it? The text says that when they heard this question, they stopped dead in their tracks, and they were sad because they're overwhelmed. Where do you begin? How would you have explained from the beginning what happened in Ferguson? Where do you start? You start with the institution of slavery in America? You start with the Civil War? Do you start with the Civil Rights Movement? You talk about violent video games or a media-saturated culture or institutional racism or patterns of poverty and discrimination in urban areas or all the similar cases that have come before. How do you tell somebody what has happened here today? Mary and Clopas have the same problem. Where do you begin describing what has just taken place in Jerusalem? When you walk by somebody and they say, "Hey, how's it going?" Do you ever feel a moment of panic? Like, what am I supposed to say? What are they really asking? How is it going? Do they really want to know? Should I tell them? Should I talk about what I'm working on at work or my family or the crisis that just happened? Oh, it's fine, is how you answer, right? Or lately, busy. It's going busy. That's what we all say now, right? How is it going? What are you talking about? Where do you begin with such things? Imagine yourself walking home after a long and tiring and confusing week. And imagine a familiar stranger coming alongside and saying, "What are you thinking about?" And imagine that he really wants to know. And imagine that for some reason you feel comfortable answering that question for real. What would you say? Where are you today? What are you talking about? Let that question be your question for a moment. I'd like to invite you to stop and reflect. Imagine Jesus asking you that. What are you worried about? What are you confused about? What are you thinking about? What are you excited about? What are you talking about? As much as they're surprised that this familiar stranger doesn't know what they're talking about, that he seems genuinely interested, so they try and answer him. They begin and they say this in verse 19. They said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it's now the third day since these things have happened. Moreover, some women from our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back saying they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said. But him, they did not see." The story they tell is about a poor carpenter, Jesus of Nazareth. The story begins with anticipation, with expectation. This guy did amazing things. He was a prophet. He was mighty in word and deed. Everybody was talking about him. And they say, "We had hoped that he was the one, to redeem Israel." See, when they said that, what they meant was that Jesus of Nazareth would solve their problem, the big problem that they faced. And that problem was the Romans. See, Jerusalem in that time, all of the Jewish area in that time was occupied by foreign power, brutal and vicious and violent. The Romans ruled by fear and intimidation. They taxed whenever they wanted. They took whatever or whomever they wanted. You weren't safe in that part of the world in this time in history. You never knew when legions of Roman soldiers would come through your village and disrupt everything. But these two travelers had hoped. They thought maybe, just maybe, this Jesus of Nazareth, this poor carpenter, could rise up and fix it and bring them back to the life that they wanted to live. They thought he could end the pain. But then he died. He didn't just die. He was killed by the Romans, crucified on their cross. He didn't beat Rome. Rome beat him. He didn't end the pain. The pain consumed him. The story they tell begins with anticipation and expectation, but then it moves into disappointment and loss. But the third stage is confusion. And then some women went to the tomb and they said they couldn't find him. And they talked about angels, and we sent some men to verify what had happened. And even they couldn't find him. But they didn't see angels, and they didn't see Jesus. So now we don't know what to think. Now we're confused. Should we be angry that someone stole his body? Should we be hopeful that maybe he's alive? But what would that even mean? Should we be suspicious that this is some trick by the Romans or by the chief priests? What's going on? Expectation gave way to disappointment, and now they're just confused and tired, and they're in despair. They don't know what to think. They just want to go home and go to bed. They're done. Frederick Buechner, a Christian novelist, describes Emmaus this way. "Emmaus is the place that we go in order to escape. A bar, a movie, wherever it is, we throw up our hands and say, 'Let the whole damn thing go hang.' It makes no difference anyway." Have you ever felt that way? Felt like you were stupid to even think that your problem could be solved. You should have known better. There's no hope. There's no change. There's nothing that ever gets better. It all doesn't matter anyway. This is Mary and Clopas walking home to Emmaus. They were confused and sad and not sure where to go next. And then this familiar stranger starts walking with them, and he puts his arm around them and he tells them it's going to be okay. He comforts them. No, actually, he doesn't do any of those things. He says, "You guys are stupid. Don't you know the story? Haven't you read the book?" He says, "You've managed to get the story wrong your whole lives, and you haven't even realized it." Listen to what he says, beginning in verse 25. He said to them, "Oh, foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself." This guy who just walked up to them tells them that the story they had assumed and understood and believed and expected and gotten excited about wasn't the real story. They were disappointed. They had wanted something from the world. They'd wanted something from God that hadn't actually been promised to them. They thought that the events of the past week had failed their story. But this familiar stranger says, "Have you considered that your story has failed those events?" They thought the Jesus of Nazareth didn't live up to their expectations. But this guy says, "What if your expectations didn't live up to him?" So here's the second question we might ask ourselves. First, we're asked about what's really going on. And then we're asked, do we know the real story? Do we really believe what is actually true about the world? What do you assume and expect and think about the world around you? What story do you believe? We all have a story that helps us to interpret the events that happen to us. It gives our lives meaning. It helps us to understand the things that happened and what we ought to do about them. It guides us forward. It gives us purpose. We all have something that helps us in life. And there's a lot of stories out there. Work hard and you'll eventually succeed. Follow your heart and you'll find happiness. Get the best education so you can get the best job. Find true love, and no matter what else happens, you'll have someone to share life with. Go to church every Sunday and your life will work out exactly the way you want it to. The problem with there being so many stories is that we don't know which one to pick. How do you know which story is the story? Every story answers a few questions, but it leaves other questions open and up in the air. If God is real, why is there so much pain in the world? If God isn't real, why is there so much beauty? How do you pick which story? What often happens is that you end up believing a story until it fails you. You think that working hard will get you what you want until you lose your job for no reason. You think that romance will complete you until your marriage falls apart. You think that if I just do this, everything will go right until you follow the rules and the bottom drops off. A lot of stories work just fine until crisis hits. Then what? Most of us aren't prepared to suffer. That's what happened for Mary and Clopas. They thought they knew how things were supposed to go, but when the hero died, everything fell apart. We need a story that helps us to make sense of pain. When I first started preparing this sermon, I was thinking about the co-pilot who crashed a plane into the Alps, killing 150 people. But today, that story is old news because gunmen in Kenya entered a college, killing just as many people. what's happening in our world? How do we account for these things? What's happening in our lives? We have broken marriages and hidden addictions and financial crises and confusion and depression and despair. How do we make sense of all of this? What story makes sense of the suffering we see around us and within us? What story makes sense of a hero on a cross and the long Saturday of wondering, what happened? Where do I go from here? Mary and Clopas weren't prepared for a dead hero. But then this familiar stranger started walking with them, and he told them a new story. He showed them how the words they had always read, the prophets and Moses and the story they had wrapped their lives around, how that story itself predicted suffering. How it talked about how suffering wasn't just there, but it was necessary for the Savior himself to enter his world and experience the suffering that was everywhere. That story talked about a hero who went through injustice, who himself was oppressed, who felt pain, a hero who was bruised and humiliated and killed and betrayed. See, the familiar stranger told them a story that made sense of suffering, that tried to explain how all of this could happen and how that could possibly not be the end of the story. But they weren't so sure. I mean, that's a whole different way of thinking. How do you just put that on your life all at once? They were interested, but they weren't convinced. Listen to what happens next in verse 28. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He, that is, this familiar stranger, acted as if he were going farther, but they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. This guy wraps up his explanation. He tells them this grand story, and then he gets coy. And he says, "Oh, I got so much to do. I really need to get going. It's been nice talking with you." He pretends like he's going on. And you think, what are you doing? This is your chance. Make the ask. Ask them to put their faith in you. Do something. Take the opportunity. But he says, this is up to them. I'm going on. The ball's in your court. And they say, "Hey, hold on. We're interested. We don't know about this, but come stay with us and let's keep talking. Let's see where all of this leads." They want more. And so he agrees. He goes to their house. He sits down to eat with them, and they must have realized that there's something special about this guy, because even though he's the guest in their home, he plays the role of the host. And this is what happens in verse 30. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" The familiar stranger takes the bread for the meal. He blesses it, he breaks it, and he distributes it. And in that moment, everything made sense. These two travelers remembered the bread that God rained down on their ancestors in the wilderness. They remembered the bread that they didn't have time to bake, that they had to take unleavened because they were fleeing Egypt that very night. They remembered the holy bread that King David ate because it was an emergency. They remembered that Jesus of Nazareth had multiplied bread for a hungry crowd and fed thousands on a few loaves. They thought, didn't he talk about being the bread of life? And a few nights ago, didn't we sit with him as he broke the matzah and gave it to us and said, "This bread is my body given for you"? And in that moment, all of it came rushing together, and they saw They realized, they understood, finally. It's time for a vocab lesson. In ancient Greek drama, this moment, what we have just experienced, is called the anagnorisis. All right, here's some trivia for your Easter lunches that you can break out for anybody that wasn't at PBC. Can we say that together? Anagnorisis. Anagnorisis. I checked the pronunciation online just before this morning, so the internet's never wrong, so you know you're saying it correctly. Now, the anagnorisis is that turning point in a Greek drama where the main character reveals something about himself that changes everything that happened before that point. If you've seen The Sixth Sense, it's that moment where you realize this little boy who sees dead people, the counselor he's talking to, is actually dead himself. If you haven't seen the movie, it's been 15 years, so sorry for the spoiler. Or The Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader saying, "Luke, I am your father." And now everything makes sense in the story. That's the anagnorisis, okay? In this moment, when this familiar stranger breaks the bread, these two travelers look back. If it were a movie, they would have said, "We want to watch it again from the beginning, because now we can understand everything he said in a whole new light." The power of that moment is that it makes you rethink your past, makes you ask, what was really happening? And that's the moment where the story that the familiar stranger told became real. Because when they heard it, they heard him talk about suffering, they heard him say it was necessary that he suffer and then enter into glory, but they thought, well, we don't really want to get our hopes up again, we've been disappointed in the past, we're not so sure. But when they saw that Jesus of Nazareth was alive, when they realized that that glory could be real, then they allowed themselves to have hope. Because most of us are afraid of hope. Hope is scary. We've been disappointed. We've been let down. We don't let ourselves hope in things because a false hope is worse than no hope at all. In The Shawshank Redemption, the inmate Red tells his friend Andy, "Hope is a dangerous thing. Hope can drive a man insane." So Mary and Clopas didn't want to hope until they knew that Jesus was alive. And that's the moment they said, okay, now it all makes sense. So if you are not a follower of Jesus, you might be thinking, well, it's a great story. I'd really love for suffering to end in hope. I mean, wouldn't that be great? But why would I believe it? Is that story true? Why would I pick that story? Well, the hope of that story isn't real to you until you've encountered Jesus, like Mary and Clopas. Once you see him, once you meet Jesus, then everything makes sense. Maybe you feel like you haven't encountered Jesus yet. Maybe that sounds like some Christian hocus pocus to you. But maybe you have encountered Jesus and you didn't realize it. Maybe some of you have encountered Jesus long ago, but you write it off as that stage in your life or that Jesus phase, or now I'm grown up and I know better, or my family used to, but I'm here because it's Easter, but that was just then. Maybe some of you have encountered Jesus and you do know him, and you're excited to celebrate his resurrection, but you want new perspective on what God is doing in your life. There are many ways to encounter Jesus. I met him through the love of a youth group where I saw that the stories of Jesus, the ideas of a loving God, got real in people's lives. I've known people who have met Jesus when they got miraculously healed, or they found Jesus in an intimate moment of prayer, where God suddenly revealed himself in a powerful way. Sometimes we think, well, I didn't encounter Jesus the way that person did, so I must not have ever met him. But Jesus makes himself known to us in different ways. He speaks to us with what we'll hear. Perhaps this morning, you're able to look back, and like Mary and Clopas, you're able to say, wasn't my heart burning that time? Didn't it make sense? And maybe I should have paid attention to it. Mary and Clopas have been asked two questions by Jesus, but now they ask the question. And this is our final question that we would ask of ourselves. What sets your heart aflame? When has your heart been on fire? And what was happening? Could that have been Jesus? Could that have been the story? If we live in a world of competing stories, how do we pick? How do we know which one is true? Well, perhaps it's the story that makes sense of suffering and gives us hope. Perhaps it's the story that sets our hearts on fire, that gives us meaning and purpose and allows us to look forward and look back with new perspective. Maybe this morning gives you the perspective you need to look back on your life and see those times that Jesus walked alongside of you, listening to you, helping you to see the true story. Today we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Today we remember that he is alive. Today is the event, the moment that makes it real. Death was defeated. Eternal life is real. Pain isn't the end of the story. And if that's true, if that could be true, if pain has purpose, if suffering can be redeemed, if Jesus was the one not just to redeem Israel, but to redeem the world, to make sense of the suffering and to give hope, if that's true, wow, that's a story that sets our hearts aflame. What are you talking about? What's going on for you? What is current? What are you worried about? What story do you believe? How do you make sense of the things in your life, of the things in the world? And what sets your heart aflame? Have you encountered Jesus without realizing it? Will you follow him? Will you trust him? For Clopas and Mary, everything changed in that moment. And after that happened, they did something differently. They left Jerusalem in disappointment, but because of what happened, they went back. Listen to how the story ends in verse 33. They rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. They went back to the beginning. They went back to where it all started for them. They had a new story that made sense of the pain, that incorporated everything, and that gave them a vision for moving forward. So that allowed them to go back into the place where things didn't make sense, to go back into the place of pain, to go back to face the suffering that previously had only left them confused, but now gave them hope. Look around at the world that we live in. It's broken and it's tired. Here in Silicon Valley, people have energy, they have drive, they have ambition, they have speculation, they expect that something will happen, they aim to be the next big thing. But they don't have hope. They're building it themselves. We're building it ourselves. We're trying so hard. This valley needs hope, needs to know that God is real, that he is at work, that he enters into suffering and redeems it. This valley needs to know that Jesus is alive. And it needs to have people who bring that hope, who are willing to go back to Jerusalem, to go into the hurt, and to proclaim hope. People who aren't afraid to get dirty, to face confusing situations, but to find the hope of Jesus in it. In a small way, that's what we're going to be doing in 3 weeks. On that weekend that we call Beautiful Day, we'll be moving our worship from inside these walls into the community. And we'll be doing things to bring hope to people. Little things, small things, painting blacktops, building shelves, cleaning classrooms. But those things are symbols. It's like Jesus breaking the bread. Those things that we do mean so much more. They mean that hope is possible. They mean that God loves his creation. They mean that he's still here, looking out for those in need. Once you encounter Jesus and find hope, you follow him back into the world. to bring hope to others. The story we've encountered this morning is worth building your life around. Let Jesus walk alongside of you. Let him tell you the real story. Let him make sense of your suffering and your pain. And follow him back to Jerusalem with new perspective and a new purpose. He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
Amen.